Call to order the regular meeting of the Oceana Community Service District Board of Directors for Wednesday, January 24th at 5:30 p.m. We have a call to roll.
Director Vernet?
Here.
Director Angelo? Director Colwell?
Here.
Vice President Austin?
Here.
President White?
We raise for the flag salute.
Attention, salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Move on to the agenda review. We got any changes, amendments? I see something.
Can we ask, I would like to, if I may?
Yes.
That we move the report of the sheriff's office up before, prior to our closed session, since the officer's here.
I would second that, if it needs a motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Yeah, aye.
Opposed? Carries 5-4-0, one absent.
And then Ms. Cassiola has a change, too.
President White, members of the board, we have modified our recommendations in item 8B. We have provided a modified staff report with the item that has been added to the San Luis Obispo County Public Works for our DWR invoice for state water. This adjustment will increase our total cash disbursements from $55,255.17 to $502,477.17. So at the appropriate time, the recommendation would be for the approval of staff recommendations in 8B as modified.
Thank you.
I'll motion that we accept and approve the agenda as revised.
Second.
It's moved and seconded that we approve the agenda as revised. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 4-0. One absent. Now, we could move on to staff reports from the Sheriff's South Station. Let you introduce yourself.
Yes, good evening. My name is Sergeant Jeff Nichols, and I'm a supervisor here at our substation in Oceano. And I'm here in place of Commander McDonald, who, of course, sends his regrets that he can't be here. But I'm here to offer you some general information and answer any questions that you might have. So, with that being said, I recently prepared some statistics for our substation in general. Our substation, you know, covers about 680 square miles, and our jurisdiction runs all the way from Shell Beach to the Santa Maria River, all the way out 166, all of rural Rio Grande, all the way down into Oso Flaco. So, primarily, we have two areas of patrol, which we call beats, and beat 6 is Oceano and rural Arroyo Grande. Beat 7 is everything from Carpenter or Calendar Road up on the Mesa all the way south and east into Napomo is what we call beat 7. So I ran the statistics station-wide and specific to the beat areas for 2017. And just in general terms, for Oceano area, or our beat 6, which would encompass your jurisdictions, we had a total of 481 arrests in 2017. The vast majority of those arrests were either warrant arrests or arrests for narcotics violations. Those were the two highest categories of arrests that we had here in this area. The third most number of arrests were domestic violence related. I think I could argue that the warrants, the narcotics, and the domestic violence all pretty much go hand in hand. Since they introduced Prop 47 and they essentially decriminalized a lot of controlled substances, basically made possession of heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, all of these very powerful controlled substances, they made them a misdemeanor instead of a felony. So in effect, now if we stop somebody on the street and we see somebody who has heroin in their possession, for example, the best we can do is write them a ticket. It's a misdemeanor charge. Even if we took them to jail, the jail is going to turn around and cite release them from the jail. Essentially, we don't want to waste jail staff's or custody staff time by taking somebody up to jail that they're just going to release out the front door after we take them there. So with that being said, I think we are seeing a lot more people out in the streets in possession of narcotics committing petty crimes because of it. Because generally speaking, most people that have an addiction problem are stealing things of value to support their habits. And so consequently, some of those crimes have gone up, the thefts from vehicles, vehicle burglaries, thefts from persons, things like that. So, and in addition to those arrestable offenses that we had, we also took nearly 500 other reports on top of that, just in the Oceania area. And those reports include, most of those are non-criminal. However, some of them may be reports that we take that we refer to the district attorney's office for prosecution. But a lot of those reports might include coroner cases, people who have passed away. The sheriff is a coroner. And so we have to document anytime there's a death that falls within the jurisdiction of the coroner's office. And, you know, it could be neighbor disputes or simply wants to report something that happened so we have a record of it, those types of things. So we're very busy. If you take all those numbers for Oceano and pretty much double them, that's what we're doing just out of our substation. So we had over 900 arrests out of our substation in 2017 and took over another 950 additional reports on top of that. So our guys are working very hard. They're very busy and doing an excellent job. So one of the local specific problems to Oceano has been the transient occupation of the levee. And that is something that has been of great concern to myself and the commander. And this is my second time assigned here to the South Station as a supervisor. And so when I came back last January, you know, that has become a priority for me. And we've been able to effectively remove all of the transient occupation from the levee. In addition to that, we've pretty much effectively removed all of the transient occupancy in the outlying areas adjacent to the levee. These people have to go somewhere. We're not entirely sure where they've gone, but we know that they remain in the area to some degree. There's only one small pocket of transient activity, which is over off of Taylor's property here, up close to the levee that we're working on now. Our CAT team, our community action team, made up of two deputies, that team was created specifically for the purpose of dealing with the transient populations. And it's not just an enforcement unit. It was created to provide services and help to the transient population in hopes that they will change their situation in order to be more self-sustaining and get them off the streets on a permanent basis. So everybody that we've contacted in the Oceano area who is transient has been offered services in the way of social services, shelter options, help with getting driver's license or applying for Social Security benefits or things like that. In fact, when they did the levee cleanup in recent history, we went down there with an entire team of people from homeless outreach, from social services, who went with us as we walked the levee. And anytime we came across somebody, we introduced them to these people to offer the services that they could use to help improve their situation. So. With that being said, that's kind of a broad overview of the activities at our station here, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Do any of those people accept those services? Do a few of them accept?
Based on my personal experience, Very few. Very few have. Very few have.
Yes. On the Prop 47 where you can only ticket when they have the drugs, what if they're under the influence of drugs? Is that still a ticket or do you have to take them in?
No, that's different because when somebody's under the influence of a controlled substance, obviously their state of mind is altered. And so it becomes a fiduciary responsibility on our part not to release that person out in the public where they could possibly get hurt or injured. So if we come across somebody who's under the influence of drugs, we will take them into custody and take them up to county jail.
I had a quick question, if I might.
Yes. Yes.
So on the increases, or I shouldn't say increases, but on the warrants or arrests, because what? Are you seeing people who are getting the misdemeanors not showing up for court and then getting a warrant for their arrest?
That's a direct correlation.
Okay.
Because there is, you know, typically speaking, when somebody would go to jail before, it was a felony. And they either had to post bond or they had to be arraigned in court. It's a little bit different feeling when they're brought before the court and they're looking at the judge and the judge tells them, you have to be back here on this date or I'm not going to let you out, versus us just having them sign a ticket and it's out of sight, out of mind, and then they typically don't show up. So that's part of the reason. I mean, we're encountering people that have, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 warrants for their arrest is not uncommon. Simply because they don't appear.
Is not showing up for court a crime also? Or is that?
It is a violation, and so when you get a warrant, it'll say something like 978.5 or something like that, PC, which is failure to appear on a summons to appear in court for a particular matter or something like that. So, but the court treats that as a violation of court. And not necessarily an additional crime. So, but what happens is eventually the judges get fed up with people not showing up and they may increase their bail or remand them into custody until their case goes before the court.
The transients that you're seeing out here, where are they from? Are they local or are they from other parts of the state? And what parts of the state are they from? And
most,
how do they end up here?
Most of them are local. And I would tell you that some of them I've been dealing with throughout my law enforcement career. I started with the city of Grover Beach Police Department 22 years ago. And I worked there for a short period of time before I came to the sheriff's office. But I'm dealing with a lot of these same people that were having problems back then, and they're now homeless because of their own circumstance. So most of them are local, and we do get some people, new people coming into the area. There's a gentleman that's been holding a sign up, a religious based sign down here on the corner.
Is he a homeless person?
I believe he is. We haven't had any reason to contact him per se. So, you know, we don't just routinely go up and start, you know, contacting people for no particular reason. So we've kind of left him alone. But he's an individual I haven't seen in this area before. And he could be somebody that is simply passing through, or he might end up here. But most people are, I would say, lack of a better term, indigenous to this area. But we do have a few people that move into the area.
Thank you. Andrew?
Yeah, I did have a question, and actually, Pablo, you'd said regarding the numbers, has there been any sort of, between looking, I don't know if you have numbers 2016 and 2017, any increases as far as what the numbers that you were, the arrests and?
I don't have the specific numbers to provide you,
okay.
But I do know that the basic theft-related crimes has increased.
Mm-hmm.
From 2016 to 2017, and I think a lot of us anticipated that happening, because we know that the only time a lot of people get clean is when they're in custody for a significant period of time, and it's no small coincidence that when we take a certain individual into custody and they're in custody for 2, 3, or 4 months, all of a sudden all of our vehicle thefts drop off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there's a direct correlation between that. So So to answer your question, yeah, there is a direct correlation, but I don't have those exact numbers to provide.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Sergeant Nichols, what is the jurisdiction, your jurisdiction, contrasting to state parks?
Well, state parks is responsible for the property that belongs to the state, essentially. We being a county entity, we have law enforcement powers throughout the entire county and the state for that matter. Any peace officer has peace officer powers throughout the state. So if state parks leaves the beach and they go through Grover Beach and they see something, they can take enforcement action and do what they need to do. But their primary purpose is to patrol state parks jurisdiction. That would be the campground and the beach and any areas directly surrounding those. And I would add, state parks, we have a very good working relationship with state parks and their rangers. They're very complimentary to us when we need help and vice versa. Occasionally we end up down on the beach and some people get stuck and some don't. Those of us who have grown up here don't seem to get stuck. But at any rate, we have a good working relationship with them. So they're primarily focused just state park property.
So you would have the primary jurisdiction over the levee area?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And then the state parks have primary jurisdiction like 60 feet or 90 feet, whatever it is, west of the housings on Strand?
I'm not sure of I'm not sure what the setbacks are, but any identified geographic area that is deemed to be a state beach is their jurisdiction. And I don't know what the setbacks are from the houses to the beach.
In front of the houses of the sand.
Yeah.
It's a 60-foot county, and then after the 60 is state park.
Okay.
But not to say, I was out there off of Strand and walking around on foot the other night and creeping in the shadows looking for a bad guy. And the boundaries don't mean a lot when we're on a specific task. So.
Thanks.
Sure.
Anything else? Anyone else? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much for coming. We appreciate
You're welcome.
It.
And I know that you meet twice a month. And
yes.
I'm going to make every effort to be here probably the latter part of the month, every month, just to make sure that I keep you guys updated on what's going on. So.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's televised to the world, you know.
I beg your pardon?
We televise it to the world.
Okay, fantastic. I'll put on my best face. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant.
Move on to closed session.
Board will adjourn to closed session pursuant to Government Code 54956.9D2. This is conference with District Counsel regarding anticipated litigation. There are two matters to be discussed.
Ask for public comment, but I see that there's no one in the audience, so we'll move ahead. Call the meeting back into order. We have a report out of closed session, please.
The report out of closed session is no reportable action. Direction was given to staff and legal counsel.
Thank you. Thank you. Moving on to public comment on items not in the agenda. The public comment period provides an opportunity for members of the public to address the board on matters of interest within the jurisdiction of the district that are not listed on the agenda. If a member of the public wishes to speak at this time, public comment is limited to 3 minutes. I do not see anybody coming forward, so we will press on to special presentations and reports, staff reports. General Manager Ogren.
Yes, President White, members of the board. Our field supervisor, Tony Maricino, is out ill, so hopefully he'll have a quick recovery.
Chief Five Cities Fire Authority Chief Steve Lieberman, I anticipate him to be here about 6:30. He indicated that he wanted to be here for item 9C, and I had given him my best estimate that I thought we would be there at about 6:30, and that it's probably going to be pretty close. And, of course, we heard from Sergeant Nichols a minute ago. My real quick update as a general manager report is that we're very busy. The Water Resource Reliability Program, Canon, has initiated their work. The Local Hazard Mitigation Plan, our Cal EOS representative is going to be here on February 9th. So your board authorized in December to distribute requests for proposals, and I still have to do that. It ended up being that December and Five Cities Fire Authority caused a change in priorities, at least on a short term. The plans and specs for our construction projects are also like the fourth number one item on my priority list right now, and recruitment of our part-time solid waste manager and water systems operator is also. So I've got about five different work products that I need to really be able to focus on. And the auditors will be here in February, so staff is very busy. And that provides my report.
Thank you. Then we'll move on to Board of Directors and Outside Committee reports. Let's start with Director Rene.
Yes, I actually, last week, I was able to attend the Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting. It was very quick. It was a very small agenda. I think the meeting lasts about 40, 45 minutes. Just a few items of note. Really, the biggest one would be they distributed the proposed budget for Zone 3 for the 2018-2019 fiscal year. So that won't be voted on until March 22nd at the next Zone 3 meeting. I know the packets, I think, are coming to They already got to our administration. So the overall increase proposed is 2.9%. But in looking in OSHA, I'm sure we'll be discussing this at a future meeting, but for Zone 3 billing, though, it's less than $1,000 more than this past year. So, but I know we'll be discussing it more at a future.
And I did take a quick glance at it, and on the surface didn't see anything that worried me or jumped out at me.
Yeah, I agree.
And Carrie will be attending the Finance Committee meeting in February.
Yeah.
Perfect. So just a couple other items. They're going to be sending out the RFP for the spillway assessment up at Lopez. Should be going out in the next month or two is what we were told. The only other update they're doing is regarding inundation maps that they discuss, and that's for a catastrophic event, something like Lake Oroville, that they're having to look at, you know, what would happen, how quickly downstream from the lake, as well as from the plant, I think, itself, which is a little further down. And I think that is actually roughly it. Again, like I said, a very quick meeting.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Vice President Austin?
Yes, I attended two meetings. I went to the Zone 11A meeting last week, and my follow-up with the sheriff said about the creek, there was the sheriff's department and the county did a big cleanup in November, and they took out 16,000 pounds of trash out of the creek, and they moved all the homeless out. And the sheriff is doing, like, they do weekly sweeps through the creek to stop any more new developments. And the big rain we had January 8th and 9th, there was no big issues. We got 2 inches of rain here, and on the 9th is when the creek breached at the beach at 10 a.m. on the morning of the 9th, and everything was running smooth. And they think some of the what helps us with our flow is the Carpenter Creek in Pismo Beach is running really good, and that takes a lot of that water. So that was they had a really good flow there, so they think that's what's helping.
So, and they said they're continuing to check the creek for fallen trees and limbs before and after every rain. So, then we got a report on the wastewater management program that was they call it the lagoon restoration or the cleaning of the creek bed that was permits were applied for in 2010 for that project, and that's the sediment removal and the vegetation removal and raising the north levee in places. So we just got an update that they are still continuing to work on that. The permits were applied for in 2010, and the last time it was 2013 when they were looking at it, but then the National Marine Fisheries came back with jeopardizing the steelhead. So they're coming up with some more different kind of approaches and plans to try to get it. But they kind of thought that we might have something happening in the next year. So maybe, do you know anything?
Yeah, I can add a little bit to the discussion.
Okay.
So the through National Marine Fisheries Services, who is responsible for the steelhead trout, in order to get an Army Corps of Engineer permit, Section 404 permit, the Army Corps has to consult with the resource agencies that are responsible for any endangered species. And so that leads to the consultations with NIMS, is the sort of the acronym. NIMS's opinion that's come out, or tentative, whatever the true status is, and it's what's called a jeopardy opinion. And the jeopardy opinion means that if you implement the project, it will have some level of harm to the species. It somewhat contrasts with county CEQA determinations that had indicated that the project was going to be an environmental benefit. So that jeopardy opinion had resulted in a lot of discussions. The apparent direction of NIMS then is to allow the county to proceed with the work subject to doing, and I can't remember if it was 6 or 8 acres of mitigation work within the lagoon.
Yes.
8 acres of mitigation work. The evaluation of what type of mitigation work would likely also look at an evaluation of replacing the existing flap gates with some sort of an alternative structure. As a general comment in my prior employment with County Public Works, I was, working with the staff there at the county to do that very thing and to look at alternates with respect to the flap gates. Essentially, the culverts that go through the levees establish a flow line and higher than the water elevation, higher than the original creek, and you create the water backup, sedimentation, and the meadowing effect that's going on right now and all the growth of the tules. So it wasn't really a surprise to me that NIMS came out with that particular mitigation strategy. However, actually doing the mitigation work in that scenario could be very challenging, and so Public Works will apparently be put on going down that road. That's generally speaking, it's a good thing. I think that the money and what they're going to actually have to do, there's a lot of uncertainties associated with that. I think there's reason to question NIMS jeopardy opinion, but I think that there's also those compromises that the county has to look at sometimes in order to move forward with the water management plan. They might have to agree to NIMS's position.
Well, yeah, and the thing they said about the Sand Canyon flap gates, where they were talking about they wanted to make it go natural like it used to, where there would not even be any gates, and then the ocean water. And we were talking about the reed removal, and they said that the ocean, the salt water would probably kill, with the movement, because when that water sits like that, that's what makes them grow, and that would probably clean out the lagoon and make it like it used to be.
And that's consistent with a number of the conversations that I've had with individuals over the years.
If you're walking down the levee, then you're going to have, how do you get to the beach then?
Well, I think the idea that complete removal of the flap gates would be more challenging because then during the high tides and the storm surges,
right.
you don't have anything to protect
right.
the lagoon area. But there are devices, whether they're rolling gates that are like common in New Orleans area and other types of structures that might be open mm-hmm. for the, you know, most of the year, and then just prior to major storm events, they close them up. So it seems to me that there is some opportunity there for really improving the lagoons and everything and trying to reverse the growth of the tules. But it's easier said than done, so we'll have to monitor and see how things go moving forward.
Okay, well, that was it for the Zone 1-1A. And then I attended the sanitation district meeting last Wednesday. And on our agenda there, we had the financial plan update, which was in 2017, we had a Bartle, the company that does the Bartle, I can't think. Anyway, Bartle Wells and Associates
yeah.
did a financial plan update. So, and the purpose was to provide district information that necessary so to apply for the state revolving funds to support a redundancy project. So since that last update, the cost, the estimate to construct the redundancy program has gone from $20 million to $24 million, so that's a $4 million increase. So we voted to have them look at it again, do another update and see where we are, you know, check out what's going on with, address the questions, check out the expenditures and everything. And in the original contract that they did the first financial plan, there was still some money left over, so it isn't costing us any more money. It's just finishing up what we had already budgeted on that. So then we had a budget adjustment to support the repair of our primary digester number one. So we approved that. The digester, we had originally budgeted $200,000 for the repair of the digester, but when they went in to clean it recently and they did an inspection, they found it was in much really severe need of repairs. So that came up with an additional $466,000 needed to repair it correctly. So now the cost is $666,000. And that will be, they go in inside, they have to change out the whole coating that's inside the digester and replace with, they have to coat it with mortar and epoxy to keep it, and it's in bad need of that. And then there's also the valves, the mixing valves on the outside, and they are the originals from 1965, and they're rusted and corroded. So they have to do all that. So we agreed to do that budget adjustment so that digester can be repaired, because it's very important for it to work correctly. Hello. So and that was it. So that's all I have to report.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Colville.
I attended the Five Cities Fire Authority board meeting on January 19, and it's going to be the subject of much more discussion here this evening. I would just summarize very quickly a lot of discussion. Basically, the representatives of Grover Beach and Arroyo Grande both indicated that they would recommend to their respective city councils that they come up with the money somehow to fund the transition into the full-time fire service from the reserve service that the fire authority has had since its beginning. There was one vote in that regard. The result of that vote was 2-1. Both the representatives of Arroyo Grande and Grover voted in favor of the additional funding. I voted no, simply because it would be deceptive of me to indicate that we had additional funding that we could make available for such a thing, even if we wanted to. So we'll have more discussion about it later this evening.
Okay.
Oh, I should add, I went to the Five Cities Fire Authority Board meeting because our president was fighting the flu bug, and I'm the alternate, so I took Karen's place.
Thank goodness.
Are you better?
Yeah, I'm a lot better now.
You look better.
Yeah.
President White, I need to go back for 1 second to the zoning
committee. Surely.
Thank you. And it's mostly because our wonderful staff person, Maraschino, that's usually giving updates for Lopez Lake, I should give updates on where the reservoir was at. So as of, I think, the 1st or the 3rd of January, the percentage was at 51.7%. So that was before some of the rain precipitation that did come down. The county did say that they were able to see that water from that storm actually did flow into the lake rather than just seep into the ground. So the idea and hope is that the watershed is actually looking a lot better than it has in the past. So that was positive. Now the outlook, though, and looking at so far the precipitation that we have had, which has been very minimal in going out for the rest of this rainy season, is that the projection right now that the county has is that roughly on November 1st is where we would hit the 20,000 acre feet mark, and that would put us back into the low reservoir response plan. So hopefully we'll be getting a lot of rain in the next couple of months. But yeah, they're already starting to make those. I think at the TAC meeting as well, that they're starting to look at, reviewing what's been done in the past with the drought that has occurred, might still be in, just to see that how they went through the process and going to the LRP and how the storage rights and all that everything still looks good. So I don't know if you have anything to add, but I wanted to make sure that I pointed that out with the lake levels. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anyone else?
Not for me.
Okay. I believe we need to call for public comment on special reports and presentations, and I don't see anyone coming forward, so we'll move on. Consent agenda item. Anybody read it? Do I hear a motion? Public comment again. I'm sorry, it's right there in my agenda. I can't seem to understand what public comment says. Seeing nobody come forward, I would move we then go on consent. Somebody want to make a motion?
Yeah, I will make a motion that we approve the consent agenda items as revised, given by staff.
I'd second that.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 4-0.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. In the consent agenda, there is a resolution in order to modify some of the reoccurring payments because of the new lease.
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah.
Therefore, the consent agenda has to be approved on a roll call vote.
Does the motion stand then?
The motion stands. It just needs to be done by roll call.
Do a vote by roll call, please.
Director Bernay?
Yes.
Director Colwell?
Yes.
Vice President Austin?
Yes.
President White?
Yes. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Moving on to business items. Public comment on business items. We'll have separate comment on item C. So let's move on to item A. Consideration of an application for a single-day use permit submitted by Jimmy Paulding for County Supervisor 2018. To use district facilities on February 20th, 2018 for public political campaign activities.
Madam President, members of the board, first clarification is that the date itself may change. And so I think whatever actions your board takes tonight, we should just leave it in terms of being flexible on what the actual date might be. I'm going to provide a couple of real quick comments, and then legal counsel is going to frame the discussion for your board. The quick comments are that, you know, as the general manager for a district and knowing that we're in District 4 of the county, my general inclination is always to try to be as neutral as possible, simply because whomever District 4 chooses to elect, we want to have good working relationships with. And so I'm always concerned about, you know, how the public might perceive events such as this at district facilities. But with that said, I'm going to turn it over to legal counsel, and then I'll come back during board discussion.
Okay. President White, directors of the board, I did look into this issue. It's a new issue that I have not considered in the past. And ultimately, the district cannot expend resources, money, in support of a political candidate one way or another. So to the extent that there are any expenses associated with it at all, we would need to recover those. I know one potential cost may be staff members having to come back and clean up, close up, which would incur a cost. And so that would be have to be recovered from the applicant. And again, that's because the district can't use district funds to support any candidate. What also caught my attention about this issue is concerns of, in a First Amendment regard. Your board does allow single use of this building, of this for various reasons. It hasn't come up a lot, but it has come up occasionally. And so since your board does allow individuals to ask for use of the facility and use of the room, we have various conditions on and reasons why we may or may not, why your board may or may not want particular parties. But those reasons cannot be based on the content of someone's speech. So you can't say we will allow this type of speech within the building and not another type of speech. And that, and so to say, well, we don't want to have political speech because we don't want to seem like we are being partial one to one candidate or another, I am concerned about saying we will accept speech about bikers convention, but not political speech or speech about religious speeches. So we have to be very even-handed about how we determine who can and who cannot use it. Now, certainly, fair reasons are we don't want a particular group because they impact parking too much, or because they've made a mess in the past, or they're going to be too loud. All those things have nothing to do with the content of what's being said in the room. So that is something that I think we have to be very even-handed about. Nonetheless, fair conditions can certainly be imposed on this type of activity if your board wishes to remain completely neutral, such as limiting the or not allowing use of the Oceano Community Services District's name in connection with activities, requesting no photographs be taken with your district seal, that sort of a thing. Again, to maintain the appearance of neutrality, and of course, again, well, we don't want to use any of district funds to support one candidate at all. So with that, I can answer any questions.
I'll say what I think. I think we have new carpeting. And I hate to think of having any kind of event that would have any kind of refreshments, even coffee. And I mean, that's just a, you know, we spent money getting this meeting room, and it's our meeting room, nice and attractive and clean for the first time in a long time. And I would hate to see it used a lot for any kind of other events that aren't just linked to our needs. That's my viewpoint.
Do we know what the event would be? Is it going to be refreshments? And it just says, I just said to use, it's in the evening time, 2 hours, I think.
Yeah, we could ask about food and coffee. We do collect a security deposit.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware of that. I mean, they would have to pay for the cleanup and all of that. I'm aware of that. I just don't know. If we open it for one, it'll be open for all. I mean, we can't, we certainly wouldn't pick, and I wouldn't pick and choose. So it's either we open it up or we don't open it up is my vision, and I'll shut up.
I would like to see us open it up, even including political or campaign events. We definitely want to be even-handed about it. There's no question about it. We cannot take a position in support of one or another. But I think it would invite the community to participate in the service district. And we could definitely, we want to support the community in being politically active. Certainly want to see them to vote. And I think that if we allow one candidate here to use the facility on February 20 or whatever, we could do a letter to Lynn Compton right now and say this is what we're doing, and she's certainly invited to make application to use the premises if she wishes. But I think it's going to result in community activity. I'd like to see it.
So, you know, when I first reviewed this, I was thinking, honestly, one way. But then, thank you for bringing up that I wasn't even thinking about necessarily First Amendment, not wanting to suppress anything regarding the fact that we, as of right now, we open this up to single facility use permits. But for me, it would be different if this was somebody else making the request. I don't know if that would really matter to anybody else, but for me it does, because within our facility here, if the candidate themselves is doing a, I would see this more as like a rally in our facility. But to me, that's a little different than like a candidate forum.
Or the League of Women Voters hosting.
Or another organization saying, I want to hold it in, you know, for support of this person. And then I like your ideas. Actually, if we were to move forward, that nothing regarding the district itself should be visible, cameras, videos, you know, it's not saying that this is where it was held, you know, because I take it from that standpoint, too, is the district should remain very neutral, is I guess how I see it. And I think the candidate forum thing, whether it's for OCSD the county itself, supervisors, whatever, I think that's kind of cool. It's a local place that people can go to ask, you know. But this, to me, is a rally, which to me says something different. And I don't know. That's my view. I mean, the right next to the Oceana, the multipurpose thing, like that's right there. Like that's, you know, I think that's school district. Maybe that would be the same sort of deal. But anyway, those are my thoughts.
I am too. I'm concerned about the perception of the community services district, and because we've never had a, we do have the,
we've had the League of Women Voters.
Well, yeah, we do have the right, where they're all here, and it's an event. But to have a one,
and I have another
set of precedent, maybe, and then I know we could offer Lynn Compton also, but then every time anybody running for election or something, we have to go through this all the time. I think we need to either, I just don't feel real comfortable with it.
Well,
just for the fact of the neutrality of the OCSD. I know that last year when Matt stood out there with the logo in the background, you know, and how are you going to keep people taking pictures?
Cell phones.
Cell phones, Facebook, you know, and it'll be like, oh, OCSD. And
well, the
I mean, I'm not, I know I let the depot's always available for all the
I was just going to add one thing. The Ku Klux Klan is a recognized organization, and if you let one in, you let others in. I mean I'm just going off that they are organized in this county.
I have a question then. Here would be my question.
And
if we were to necessarily say, for political purposes, candidate forums only, does that step on free speech? And you may not know that right this second, but I mean that would be my question. Could we say that? Candidate forums, sure, but rallies.
Pretty thin line.
I don't know the answer to that at all. But what I will say is what you're doing is you're saying particular type of speech, political speech, is going to be treated differently from other type of speech. And that's what makes me concerned on this. Now,
Do we know what it, I mean, we need to know, is it a rally? Will there be a lot of people out here? I mean, or is it just like a town hall where he's going to have people come and question and answer period?
Well, I
just
think
it's a place to get people,
I think
what Jim said made sense, you know, about coming here to this building, but I
think we have to assume, you know, all of the above, that there would be Q&A, there would be individuals who are, you know, doing a rally type of thing. My understanding from legal counsel, though, is that we're really hard-pressed to deny because we allow the facility to be used for other purposes. And so because it is allowed to be used for other purposes, to deny it for this purpose would be, you know, we could find ourselves under legal scrutiny.
I'd like to see the facility used by the community as much as possible.
So,
and I don't.
I guess from my understanding of what legal counsel is saying is if your board is inclined to deny, then I think you would be directing me also to come back with some sort of a policy to basically deny, you know, the public use of the facility. And that way it's, you know, it's not just them, it's everybody, which itself can be problematic. So that's one of the questions that's in front of your board. With
really
respect to conditions, you know, things like don't use OCSD's name, address only in terms of telling people where and when it's going to be, no OCSD pictures, full cost recovery. You know, if they're in here, we could even put things over like the OCSD sign in front of the president. So if there are pictures, there's not, you know, our name out there or anything.
What about alcohol?
Okay. Oh, well, we could definitely prohibit alcohol. With respect to food and coffee, I think that that's probably well within your board's reason. That's not a First Amendment speech issue. At least, not that I'm aware of.
It's not, and I just want to point out one thing. So this thought about this First Amendment issue came to me late in the day. When I looked at this initially, I was not thinking about that. And so, in all fairness, things like what Director Bernays is asking about, is there a way to limit certain activity? I have not spent significant amount of time or any time really looking at that. First Amendment's complicated area law. It's nuanced. But when it did come into my thought process, it made me stop a little bit. So I will, in the future, I will look at maybe ways policy can be crafted.
Well, it almost seems like right now, because I would be all for that, to really take a look and see about, you know, because we don't want to limit anybody's free speech, you know, with this building and what we've already set a precedent of letting people, anybody really, you know, use the facility. But that I'm kind of now, along with Mr. Caldwell, that Director Caldwell is, since we have approved these in the past, we approved this one, but also you can reach out to Ms. Compton or anybody else. I don't know any other candidates to say, you know, I mean, I guess we can do that. The last thing I want to do is...
We will be having a candidates forum, I'm sure, back, you know, close to the team.
Sure, yeah.
We need it. The advisory council probably.
But that's the advisory council that does that.
And then we use.
And there again, the advisory council uses the building.
Yes, that's what.
I have a question. What is this room considered?
It's generally considered the boardroom.
That would be the other thing that I would wonder. Do we want to make this a multi-purpose room that can be, or is this a boardroom that is for board meetings? I mean, I guess that's just a question. I don't necessarily have an answer, but. But that could also be for a future.
It's been used for a lot of things. I mean, community-based things like the revitalization meetings and forums. And then I think, in my memory, the only other people that have used it other than really community-focused things was the dune buggy folks, or the four-wheelers folks. Excuse me, they're Jeeps. The four-wheeler folks have used it.
Well, we had a big, that was for Esposito here. We had a big party. That was years ago.
Well, yeah, let's not go back too far.
Change the name of the dunes.
Let's
to
not Oceana. Go back.
We had a big old party here. That was before we had the Beepo, so. And we ate.
So does anybody like to make a motion?
Well, again, let's go back to the neutrality thing. So what you were saying about the pictures, I mean, we need to put these conditions in there. Mm-hmm. If you think we should do it, give it a try and see what happens this time around. Something new for getting in the political thing.
How many people are allowed in this room? What's the
set of not well? That
it's like it's somewhere.
140.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was just, yeah, that's right. Thank you. We are so
the cost recovery
code enforced.
And not using OCSD's name or anything in anything. You know, I think we can go ahead and send a letter to Ms. Compton stating that she would be able to have a one-time use here. Also,
but is that any sort of privacy thing? Like somebody submits something, you can tell somebody else that that's what it's until it gets approved.
Hold on, let's see if that was a motion that's on the table.
Okay, make it a motion then.
So, my understanding of the motion would be to approve its use as requested on the conditions that. OCSD's name is not in any advertisements or anything else publication associated with the event, that there are no pictures taken that would show OCSD's
logo
or name on any of those pictures, that it provides for full cost recovery.
Mm-hmm. No alcohol.
And no alcohol. And is that a fair characterization of your motion, Vice President Austin?
Yes. Okay.
So with a motion on the table, then the question is whether there's a second.
I would second the motion and request that I think all of these conditions can be modified in the use agreement. So that
certainly
it does not need a lot of extra work by staff.
Certainly. Yeah, legal counsel and I can make sure to address. We would still use the same form as your board has previously approved, just adding in the additional conditions.
That would be my second.
And is that consistent with the motion makers?
That's fine. Okay, it's been moved and seconded.
And then, Director Brunet, if you had other questions, I guess.
I guess no other questions. I think I would request, I don't know if anybody else on the board, that maybe we revisit as far as our policy. We can look at our policy for that maybe in the future.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I think
that would
so
be good.
To get it.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Carries 3-1, one absent.
And as a procedural matter, we will make sure also to inform Supervisor Compton so that we make sure that everything is pursued in an even-handed manner.
Yes.
And we might need to look at if there's any propositions or other issues on the balance as it comes up. We'll just let people, if they want to use the building, come ask.
Certainly, and there's a little bit of discussion about a candidates forum that wasn't really a subject of the agenda item. When we bring a policy discussion back to the board, then I think at that point in time,
I think we need a policy that we don't get involved in political.
Yeah.
For the future.
Okay, and I'd like to take business items out of order. If we could move to 9C, would that be okay with everybody? Since the people are here for 9C, and then go back to 9B, is that okay?
Yes.
With the fire department.
Nine C is discussion of committee assignments for the Five Cities Fire Authority, including possible action to modify assignments, updates on issues, meetings, and communications with representatives of other agencies and directions as deemed appropriate.
Madam President, members of the board, Director Colwell had provided a little bit of a snapshot of the last Five Cities Fire Authority meeting, and I'm not sure if you would want to begin with more detail on that. I could certainly speak to the meetings with the executive committee as well.
I think my earlier brief summary really capsulizes what happened at the meeting. There's a lot more discussion that we need to have about this, I believe, but I would defer to the general manager because I think we've got some updated information from the executive committee, don't we?
Certainly. So I can begin with some of the discussion at the executive committee, which is, you know, really kind of brief right now in terms of the discussions at the executive committee are mirroring some of the discussions at Five Cities Fire Authority, as well as the discussions at the individual agencies. So the last two meetings that we've had, we've been comparing a lot of notes as to the discussions at the cities and Five Cities Fire and what have you. The most important thing right now to recognize is that the status of the direction at the Five Cities Fire Authority is in substance providing the referrals back to the different agencies. As a result, the executive committee is pretty well aware of Oceano's financial status and our challenges with revenues and budgets. And as a result, the discussions are the cities, as I had indicated in the 2018 outlook, really need to kind of take the lead in determining what they want in terms of future service levels. But even then, the city council discussions have been pretty clear that it's a challenge. Rio Grande met again last night, and Grover will be meeting on February 5th. And so they're going through their multi-year budget outlook and trying to simply figure out how they're going to follow through or their fiscal, feasibility of being able to implement what is generally recognized as a need that the Fire and Emergency Services, Five Cities Fire Authority, needs to move forward in. And so part of that action at Five Cities Fire Authority then is asking Chief Lieberman then to provide budget information in March. You know, normally it would happen after March, but they said we need you to push it up into March. So the city's meetings are going to continue, and so that they can look at their financial status and what their budgets look like next year. In February, the Five Cities Fire Authority will be looking at the prioritization of the strategic plan. And so the goal is in March then, there would be the budget outlook and the multi-year impact of transitioning over a couple of years here. The overall challenges, again, with looking at the direction that everything needs to go in is really for each of the three agencies is different. And we there's a good discussion and a good understanding of that at the executive committee level, but I don't know that it really warrants getting into those details today amongst your board, because those are the details that the City Council for Grande and the City Council for Grover Beach are going to have to address. Separately, what I had indicated to the executive committee is that what I think we at Oceano have to do is simply line up what our options are. And so as the discussions move forward at Five Cities Fire Authority, we're going to gain a better understanding of what future costs might be for Oceano to continue to participate in Five Cities Fire Authority. But it's not just a cost issue. I do believe that the discussions about how cost sharing amongst the three agencies under Five Cities Fire Authority might be subject to change. And what I was encouraging the others to consider as an approach on that today was that as the multi-year budget outlook is developed for Five Cities Fire Authority, is to maintain consistency with the current funding formulas in the interim as the transition is occurring. And then once it's implemented 100%, let's say in 3 year, if there's financial impacts of changing funding formulas, then let's identify that in year three. And the reason why that's my basic recommendation is when we address two different things that might have an impact on what it's going to cost us, but that first thing isn't going to happen immediately, it's going to happen over multiple years, then let's get through that step, because a transition from reserves to full-time firefighters, part of the question is, well, where are they going to be staffed if we don't make, you know, the 100% transition? So my general feedback on that particular point was that, again, let's keep to the basic funding formulas right now during the transition period. And if the cities have an expectation that funding formulas need to be modified, then look at what that impact is in the out year. The ad hoc committee also got together with Supervisor Compton, and that was a basic introduction of issues. And Supervisor Compton's office is coordinating meetings with both CAL FIRE Chief Jalbert, as well as County Administrative Officer Wade Horton. And those have been rescheduled, I believe, to February 9th in the afternoon. And basically, we'll meet with CAL FIRE first and Supervisor Compton's, and then secondly with Mr. Horton, the County CAO. Again, it was just an introduction of the topic. When we were near concluding, we encouraged open dialogue, that certainly Supervisor Compton should be dialoguing with Chief Lieberman, and that Chief Lieberman and Chief Jalbert should be dialoguing as much as possible, that as many conversations that covered the different details as possible will help with benefit overall dialogue. The bottom line is that there's still going to be a lot of details that need to be fleshed out over the next couple months, especially leading to the February meeting of the Fire Authority, the March meeting of the Fire Authority. So from a staff perspective, to me, our number one goal right now is, in addition to the dialogue, but from a technical perspective, is to get all of our parcel analysis together. There's multiple reasons why we want to do that. We're working on low-impact development and drainage concepts with the county, and understanding which parcels have curb, gutter, and sidewalk and which ones don't is good. We're also, it can always help to make sure to audit our own water system and the customer information in the water system. And so I'm pretty much planning right now on February some pretty detailed parcel analysis so that we're ready that when numbers are produced in terms of Oceano's cost under different scenarios, whether it's Five Cities Fire or CAL FIRE or go on our own, that we can put those into the, you know, computer, and it will tell us the parcel by parcel calculation of what a special tax might be. Because when we move from somewhat of bigger picture policy discussions that have occurred already with the strategic plan and the reserve firefighter challenges, then we're moving into these detailed discussions at the agency levels as to what is the actual impact on budgets and what's affordable. There's a certain dynamic there already, which is somewhat of a truthing process, that the policy direction from Five Cities Fire Authority, how easy or hard is that going to be actually to implement from a funding standpoint of the individual agencies? So those details are ongoing right now. And I know that Grover Beach met with their consultant, the city manager, Matt Bronson, met with his consultant this afternoon in order to do their 10-year outlook on their financing. So they're scrubbing those type of details. And my point is, we have to start scrubbing the details associated with our properties and our own constituents in Oceano, so that we know that if there's a need or a request out there, we can translate that detail, you know, to their to what's meaningful to them on a parcel by parcel basis. So there is a lot of work that's going on, both, you know, at the various agencies as well as Five Cities Fire Authority. Part of my our discussion previously was, what is the baseline for Five Cities Fire Authority? And I understand, Director Colwell, that you made a motion to that extent at the Fire Authority, which did not get a second in terms of a sort of a status quo evaluation. And one of the things that we might do is talk about how do we repose that question, because from the overall dialogue that I'm hearing is that if the ability to implement the full transition is going to be a challenge, then what kind of an evaluation is needed in order to say what are the steps that we need to take, even if we can't get there immediately. So whether that, you know, requires just additional discussion at Five Cities Fire Authority and Chief Lieberman doing some analysis, I can tell you that those kind of discussions are going on at the executive committee level in terms of how do we evaluate the status quo or what we might do sort of on an interim basis. Bottom line, there's a lot of different moving parts. So I do feel like the discussions at the executive committee have been beneficial from the standpoint of each of the agencies has a better understanding of the challenges faced by the other agencies, and our discussions of what's going on at the Five Cities Fire Authority board meetings and getting feedback has been good as well. What I want to do now is just provide a little bit of a handout, or have a handout that we can cover over just a couple minutes. I think there's enough there. And what we've discussed before is, of course, that the sort of the only form of discretionary revenues that your board has is property tax allocations. And I did get questioned a little bit at the executive committee today about property tax allocations. And as a specialist district with that single source of revenue, we've kind of known that. And I think that the other agencies know that as well. But one of the questions I got posed is, you know, our ability for interfund borrowing or something of that nature, which, of course, we've dealt with in 2015. You know, we did a significant exercise in dealing with our interfund debt and established amortization schedules to make sure that everything gets paid back as it's supposed to. That included a 15-year analysis on the funding associated with the sheriff's building. And, of course, then it was concluded with the auditor looking at everything last year. So we've done a lot of work on interfund debt. And what this schedule does is it shows what our reserves are. And it's just like our revenue sources, where we have a relatively restricted revenue source, one being property taxes. I wanted to make sure to run through this because this does not include the water or the sewer or the garbage funds, since those are enterprise funds and that money can't be commingled with any of the governmental funds. And so we essentially have one general fund, and it has four activities associated with it. Overall governmental activities, which is really just collection of property tax revenues. And then administration, which is substantially recovered through administrative cost allocations. We have the fire fund and the lighting fund. So the administration, fire, and lighting funds, those are just really kind of revenue and expenditure categories. In other accounting, you know, circles, those are called orgs or organizations. They're like profit centers, right? They don't actually carry reserve balances. Those reserve balances are carried by the governmental fund. So when we look at those four categories, the very first number that you see for governmental is $22,258. For administration is $8,339 for fire and lighting. And the total general fund balance available was about $53,000 last year. And with about $1 million of activity, it meant that we basically had about a 5% budget savings out of all of those governmental fund activities. And that $53,000 in budget savings is then in part what we're shooting for, because we don't want to run over budget, so it's hard to hit the budget right on it exactly. So we were under by about 5%, and that again equates to about $50,000. Then we have what were the beginning balances, reserve increases that your board approved substantially from that fund balance available, and then some cancellations move money around. But the ending reserves then is where I want to focus. So in the governmental fund are is where we hold the reserves, and those at the end of this fiscal year were projected to be about $234,000, a little bit more. We did the budget adjustment for $69,165 for the breathing apparatus, which will drop our ending reserves to about $165,000. $477. That number itself, I would expect property taxes to come in a little bit higher than the projected. And so at the end of this year, if it was consistent with last year, with fund balance available, that $165,000 would probably be closer to about $185,000. When we go over to the column that's called total general fund, then the because there are no reserves in admin, fire, and lighting, that reserve of $165,000 has to cover all of those activities. Now, on the administrative side, if we have budget overruns, most of that's going to be paid for by water, sewer, and garbage. So that's a little bit less of a concern. And a lighting fund itself tends to not have very many irregularities associated with it. So that $165,000 is predominantly available to fire operations. When we move over to the equipment and facilities funds, which we established a few years ago for the all-important purpose of making sure we had funds to replace equipment and to maintain facilities, there are reserves there as well. Now, the $19,576 in the equipment fund is not available because that has only been generated by water, sewer, and garbage. So if the equipment fund were dissolved for any reason, that money would have to go back to water, sewer, and garbage. The facilities fund, then, is where we track our rental revenues, with the biggest source of revenues being the county sheriff's building. And, of course, we have to repay the debt on the construction of the county sheriff's building through 2022, so the revenues are pretty well spoken. The total reserves projected at the end of the year is $357,000, and I show in red right below the box that $190,973, which is also highlighted in yellow, is restricted because those are collected from public facilities fees. So the net amount that's unrestricted is about $166,000. So that right now is facilities funds. And, of course, we have the responsibility of maintaining the fire station. We spent $40,000 earlier in this year, which We were able to do from some prior year budget savings in order to do re-roofing. $20,000 of that was allocable to the fire department, and it was funded out of the facilities fund, as opposed to not funded out of the fire department budget, but the facilities fund. The other cost of the re-roofing ended up being allocated again to water and sewer and garbage because of the administrative office. So when we take a look at those total reserves that we're projecting out of all governmental funds, and then we back out legally restricted reserves, I got a little summation problem there. It shows $210,000, and that's really a combination of the $190,000 for public facilities and the $19,000 that's restricted for equipment since it was generated by water, sewer, and garbage. But we take out the $210,000 and the $69,000 that was the budget adjustment, and that leaves us with a net at the end of the year of $331,955. And then what I show is what our operating cash is, because we don't get our property tax collections until basically January. You know, the county collects them in December and then distributes them at the beginning of January. So our six-month operating cash is about $444,000 roughly, which means that really when we start the year, we don't have enough operating cash to get through to January 1st. And we have to essentially do inter-fund borrowing to get to January 1st. And, you know, we're short by, say, the number here says $112,000, but we're essentially short anywhere from $110,000 to $120,000 if we're going to talk in big picture. And that's completely allowable for within a year to do inter-fund borrowing to cover cash flow. But it also helps to illustrate that, yes, we do have some general fund and some other reserves that have been established, but they're barely bones minimum in order to cover 6 months worth of cash flow. School districts are pretty famous. They go out to get what they call tax anticipation notes, short-term borrowing out of the financial markets in order to cover this. But again, it just sort of illustrates that our reserve situation is pretty much as tight as our basic revenue and expenditure situation. So I wanted to make sure just to share this additional detail on the financial status of the district. Certainly, we've been doing a good job in trying to set aside money for facilities and other work, and we're going to be in a lot more optimistic position on that come 2022 with the repayment of all the debt that was incurred for the sheriff's substation. So I've touched on some of the committee discussions, the interactions between Five Cities Fire, and some of the discussions with the city managers, and touched on the initial meeting that we had with Supervisor Compton. The strategic planning prioritizations is intended to be at Five Cities Fire Authority in February. A multi-year budget outlook in March. We had some basic discussions about the JPA and funding, and more to follow on that. And I'd be glad to answer questions or just encourage, you know, board discussion.
Andrew?
The only thing that I'm wondering about is under the recommendations is recommended to your board. I think we discussed this at the last meeting. As far as committee assignments, modifying assignments, I haven't really talked about that much, but was there a request or Director Caldwell, were you wanting to join the ad hoc committee?
I don't even know if we're going to have an ad hoc committee.
Well, we're going to have our own.
So, yeah, we'll have our own. So I'm probably better off staying with the Fire Authority Board assignment.
That would suggest that you might be the other member of the ad hoc committee. Are you going to have time or not?
Are there current meetings?
The next one is on February 9th in the afternoon.
In the afternoon?
Yeah.
Was that Thursday, Friday?
Friday.
Friday. Yes, that would be my only concern. I mean, I don't mind necessarily being on the committee, but I'm not might not be able to make meetings during the day like that. So, I mean, that's kind of a question, if that's okay.
Well, certainly, it's your discretion. I recognize that your timing is such that you're available when you can be available.
Yeah.
We can certainly get on the phone with you as well at times that are more convenient and keep you updated. But, you know, given the fact that this situation is going to be evolving a little bit over the next couple months, your board could also make changes down the road if you so choose. So nothing's really set in stone. I think the most important thing is that at the regular meetings, we have an opportunity to share what was discussed at Five Cities Fire, what was discussed at the ad hoc committee level, because, you know, essentially at the ad hoc committee level is where we're trying to evaluate what type of options might exist. You know, is there, you know, options associated with the county and CAL FIRE? And then how are we going to define what will become of Oceano if we're just back on our own as an independent fire department? I think those are really sort of the three options we're looking at right now. And it's not that we're out there wanting to do an alternatives analysis. It's the due diligence associated where things are at. There is a really important point that I think we made at the first executive committee meeting that I should emphasize a little bit, because you know, it's not about individuals, it's not about the crews, it's about services, it's about costs, it's what, you know, we all want to make sure that the best can be provided for our communities. And in many ways, the thing that's the distinction between the agencies is really the difference between cities and an unincorporated community. Chief Lieberman has shared information about how a number of the cities are able to advance and, you know, transition away from reserve firefighters to full-time firefighters. And likewise, we see some of the other unincorporated communities like Cayucas and Templeton specifically that are really struggling with emergency operations. And so, you know, the more that we recognize it's not an Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceano thing, and it's certainly, you know, we're not sitting there arguing with each other. We're dialoguing on what the situation is and what potential solutions might exist or the processes that we have to go through in order to try to address all the details. I summarize it as being more of a difference between what cities are able to do and what they're trying to pursue right now and versus the challenges of an unincorporated community. And we all remain hopeful that we can, you know, figure out options and solutions. The challenge is the timetable that we're under right now and whether what might be the give in terms of that. I've emphasized to your board in the past that, you know, staffing in stations has got to be talked about, and I think that those discussions at Five Cities Fire may not be all that far off in the future in terms of what is the staffing levels that are feasible and what might that mean to stations and everything. And so we got to let Five Cities Fire work through those issues and their board work through the issues.
Well, there were a couple of other things that came up at the board meeting of the fire authority on the 19th. First of all, I think everybody agrees that, you know, in a perfect world where we've got plenty of money, we would want to drastically improve the fire and safety services within our community. Arroyo Grande, Grover, as well as Oceano. Unfortunately, Oceano does not have the means to come up with that kind of money right now. It's very bleak for us. There's no question but that, excuse me, this board and the citizens of Oceano, at least all that I talk to, are very concerned about the safety of our firefighters. And we want to do our utmost to continue to provide the greatest safety possible. And fortunately, we've got a pretty good record there. Now, I don't know about the validity of some of the motions that have been passed within the fire authority. I don't know if they've necessarily been properly noticed and agendized. I'm just not sure. It seems to me that we've got spending within the fire authority that's exceeded budget without any modified budgets, and I don't know if that's permissible given the JPA. I have no idea. I did make a motion. In fact, I sort of felt like I was arguing with Chief Lieberman, which I didn't want to do, but it just seemed to me that we need more evaluation of what the heck can we do if we cannot come up with the additional money that we think would be deserved by the fire authority to provide the kind of service that we would want to expand to. So the whole thing is really centered on hiring right now 6 additional full-time firefighters, professional firefighters, and we just don't have the money for it. And yet we've got a motion that seemingly passed with or without authority at the last board meeting that Chief Lieberman should proceed with all that's necessary in order to have an additional 6 firemen hired and in place by July 1, and that would exceed, I think right now we're exceeding the budgets of the fire authority in any event. And I wish that weren't the case, but I think that's where we're at. And I don't know what that means legally for each of us within the fire authority. And what the alternatives are, who knows? As I made it clear to the fire authority board and Chief Lieberman on the 19th, I am no expert in fire, but we need to know what's available to us and what our options might be. And we're shooting in the dark right now. And it's no way to be acting responsibly. We just need to know.
And from the, so I think that in terms of validity of Five Cities Fire Authority motions, we can break that into 2 different discussions. One is with respect to budget actions itself. Clearly, any of the budget actions have to be revisited and formalized because none of the actions that were taken in November or December or last month passed unanimously. Whether or not the agenda item itself had indicated, the agenda items did not talk about any budget actions, right? So there's a position to say that, look, that wasn't covered by the Brown Act, that any budgetary actions don't have the Brown Act coverage. That's one thing to talk about. But the other side of the equation is none of them passed unanimously. So in terms of the current year budget, that question still needs to be posed to the Five Cities Fire Authority Board as a whole. With respect to the direction that the board has given the chief, I think that that can only be interpreted in terms of policy direction. And so it's understandable that the policy direction right now is to go back to the different agencies and to have the city councils talk about, what the budget implications are. And because they're still doing their meetings, that feedback hasn't been given then to Five Cities Fire Authority Board or those representatives. And so it's a big picture policy discussion right now. And it's really after the cities have the opportunity to look at their ability to afford the recommendations that I think then it's going to come back to Five Cities Fire for some additional discussions. And, the sleeves might need to get rolled up and say, okay, what are some more of the details that we need to be looking at? But yes, budgets, the formal budgetary action needs to be considered, and the tentative or the policy direction has a truthing process that needs to still be completed and go back. And I've sort of reiterated at the executive committee of what I've indicated to your board previously, is that with so many different moving parts, We really need to know what direction the cities want to move in. And once we know the direction that the cities want to move in, then we'll know better what our fiscal challenges are. And that's why, in the meanwhile, we'll be doing our parcel analysis. Related to that, Supervisor Compton did ask me what I think the likelihood of tax election passing in November is. And so it's not that I really evaded the question, but I don't have a likelihood answer. My response was, look, when we look at the options available to Oceano, it just simply becomes a community decision. You know, our job, and I know I've mentioned this before in these situations, is not to go out there and try to sell anything to the community, but to lay out the most objective information that's possible in terms of community options and everything. And it's hard because there are so many moving parts, but I am cautiously optimistic right now that the dialogues at the executive committee and what we're going to hear in the near future at the Five Cities Fire Authority is going to start getting us closer and closer to what we think the future might be looking at.
Chief, would you like the floor for a minute? Yes.
Madam President, it's great to see you back in the seat and back in the saddle. And Board, Steve Lieberman, your fire chief. I just wanted to tag onto a comment from Director Colwell from the last meeting. Your concern, whether it was properly noticed or the budget decision was appropriate, I share that concern, but I want to tell you that I share that concern from an ethical perspective. The original motion, I brought it back for further clarification from the board at the last meeting because ethically I found it unfair to potentially hire employees in full-time positions and potentially terminate them June 30th without a guarantee of funding. So I went back and asked for clarification as the department head, and I felt much better with the direction being modified to say, go ahead through a recruitment process, identify a list of qualified candidates, and anticipating action on July 1. So I share your concern. And it, for me, it was professional and ethical concerns. So we have not started the process. And as General Manager Ogren has indicated, this really boils down to the budget planning processes for all three communities, and it hasn't started yet. So there's a lot more to come. And the meeting today was very productive. I just wanted to echo my appreciation to the management team. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think our budget process has started already. I mean, I think we're... But it really comes down to we have three choices for the community of Oceana. One, the preferred choice is to stay with the Five Cities Fire Authority. The second choice would be to work out some kind of an agreement with the county and or CAL FIRE. And the third is to go it alone. Okay, I listened to the Arroyo Grande City Council meeting last night. And that's exactly what I heard from a group of people who were looking at a budget that's not in balance and a 10-year plan that shows in 5 years they'll be bankrupt. So my question right now is, I don't know that Arroyo Grande can go forward. I know Oceano can't go forward without additional funds. And before we can go forward on any kind of asking our voters for any kind of support, we have to know what our minimum service would look like if nobody funded another dollar into the fire department. Then we need to know what a little bit of money would do, and then we need to know what the amount of money that is on the table would do. So until I can tell what the absolute worst could be. And so that's where I think our ad hoc committee should start, is to go, we got this way we can go, we can go to this way, or we can go to this way. I mean, we need to know a lot more real quick, because we got to have a decision in 2 months if we're even going to think about going for a tax election. And we're going to have to find people to somehow take that forward, because this board has limited ability to take it forward. So I think things need to be done real quick, and I without a baseline, you know, without saying we're going to have one person at the station all day and we're going to have two at night, or one fire truck here part-time, I mean, we don't know anything.
Well, I think that that's why there's a little bit of frustration for the lack of a second on Director Colwell's motion at Five Cities Fire Authority, is that sort of this refusal to look at baseline at the fire authority. And, you know, it's not that Oceano is saying that that's the way it needs to go, but that idea that, is there a baseline evaluation? Because right now the only baseline we can develop is if we're on our own. So as they start getting input back from the cities, it'll, you know, we'll have to see how it's addressed at the Five Cities Fire Authority Board. But that's probably my biggest uncertainty right now, is how it's going to play out with the cities.
Chief Lieberman, may I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Would you be willing... You've heard our discussion, but we don't know what the possibilities are. Would you be willing to give us your best evaluation under two different scenarios? Number one, if everything goes very well for all of us, like we would love to see, so we had enough money to transition to excess full-time firemen, what would that look like? And then secondly, what would it look like if we cannot get the budget commitments from the three entities so that we don't hire these additional full-time? Would you be able to give us an evaluation of those two scenarios? Would you be willing to do that?
Thank you. Great question. So I believe one part of the evaluation is completed. It's called the strategic plan. It lays out our needs for the next 5 years, whether it's fire suppression. It also includes fire prevention, personnel, and administrative staff. Because just as a quick sidebar for information, a lot of the administrative support of the Five Cities Fire Authority in terms of accounts payable, payroll, a large function of HR, those are all services that are provided by the City of Arroyo Grande, as included in the JPA agreement. So there's a lot of talk about long-term independence in terms of sustainability, and some of it's driven by members of the Arroyo Grande Council. We would rather have our employees focused 100% on city business, and so what's it gonna take you to have your own payroll department, your own accounts payable department, your own HR department? So that's included in the analysis as well. But getting back to, I believe, the essence of your question, what we see 5 years from now, we've gotten a book. Today, so assuming that nothing were to happen, right, so no additional funding were to be identified, we're there, right? So we started as volunteers, made the transition to hire full-time folks that we could. We held onto the reserve firefighter program. It's struggling to survive, but that's what we have today. So the baseline analysis, and we could, I would offer that it's our existing budget. We don't have equipment replacement funding. We've got debt service for the two new fire engines. We've got a reserve budget of about $370,000. Struggling to fill those shifts is that balance between overtime from career folks. So if you may remember from the staff reports, it's about a factor of three to put a fire engineer in a reserve firefighter slot that's unfilled. At the last meeting, we actually received board direction to allow me to, I already have the operational flexibility, but to minimize the financial exposure, there may be times where we leave a shift open and we don't fill it to maintain a lesser level. So instead of eight people on a daily basis, we may go down to seven, but we don't want to get below six. So I believe we're at the baseline status quo if nothing else happened, right? Unless we're going to lose funding from the existing budget. But if we didn't get an infusion from the existing budget, we try to hold on to the reserve program for about as much money as budgeted in the reserve program. If you eliminated that program, you could hire three firefighters. That's only one additional body a day, which really impacts our service levels. So I hope that helps. I can certainly follow up and put it in more detail, but I believe status quo is where we are today.
What I'm hearing you say is that you have nothing further to contribute to an evaluation of what may be the options with those two alternatives.
I believe there's multiple levels and implementation phases and different service levels in the strategic plan. So you could pick and choose service levels in that strategic plan. I believe that board direction is going to do prioritization of the items identified in the plan at the next meeting. Today, we're pretty limited with what we can do. You've got five full-time personnel on duty, and you've got reserves that we're doing our best to recruit, retain, and deploy.
So that's 3 at Arroyo Grande, 2 at Grover, and 1 here, or 1 in a reserve here?
Full-time folks are 2 at Arroyo Grande, 2 at Grover, and 1
okay.
here.
Yeah. So that's pretty much the baseline. And the only other baseline would be to quit, to close one station part of the time.
Right. And we're hoping the reserve the reserves get us to 2 here and 3 in the other stations.
Yeah.
Well, it's disappointing that you can't provide us with more of an evaluation, is what I'm seeing. Like, I've read the strategic plan, and I've heard you talk about what you would like and all, and it doesn't give us much of a basis to make these important decisions on. That's what I see.
I wish I could give you more insight, but I believe I've given
too.
You everything I can. Thank you.
Well, my concern is that the baseline as it's being described right now is running a significant budget deficit. And so if the chief has the operational flexibility already to not backfill shifts that are vacant and not pay the overtime, then how much of that would actually have to occur? Like, how many shifts? What does that mean in terms of Oceano not having two people staffed here? Is that, you know, three?
In effect, we may end up with no fire service.
Yeah. Does it mean that 3 months out of the year we have a station closed?
Yeah.
And so going from a concept to getting that down in paper so that we know that we're looking at a potential station closure for 3 months. And then when Mayor Scholes at one of the prior meetings, you know, is saying that his station isn't going to close, is that reality or not? So going from a standpoint of this is the situation in a general talk tone and to actually putting numbers down and how many shifts aren't going to get backfilled, those are the types of things that I think really need to be known so that it can get in front of everybody's faces that Oceano might be looking at significant station closures.
And if I could offer that in the previous board meeting, in the staff report, when I looked at a way to minimize the impact of the overtime overage, I did have a number, I believe, I don't have it in front of me, of 150 shifts. And by using the methodology that we discussed at the board level, we could drastically reduce that by leaving one shift open but not two on the same day. That's identified in the report. I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me at this time. If we have two reserves, again, attempting to conserve, or as I say, control the hemorrhaging on the overtime overage, if we have two reserve spots on the same day, we will fill one of those with an overtime engineer. But that will still leave one unfilled position. And we'll have to make a determination based on operational need and where our staffing are as to what that does to impact staffing at any given station. It's important to know that Oceano has one full-time employee while the others have two. So we would either take the one reserve employee or the backfill employee to keep 2-0 staffing at every station or make other operational changes. But looking forward, we have maps and open shifts projected for the rest of the fiscal year. It really is a Ouija board because I don't know if the reserve firefighters that are currently scheduled for their open shifts or their regular shifts may have an opportunity to fill some of these open slots during the remainder of the fiscal year. So it is a bit of a moving target. We're just taking a conservative, worst-case estimate as to what our open, unfilled shifts will be for the rest of the year, if that helps. Can certainly bring that staff report if you don't have it and present that data to you.
I have it.
Well, and given the significance of the situation, it would seem to me that then those discussions at Five Cities Fire Authority would lead to some formal policy by the board of directors, you know, based on recommendations of the fire chief, on how to implement, you know, those types of sort of undesirable outcomes, right? Because if there is, if we're looking at a situation where we can't backfill certain vacancies, we don't have the money for overtime to continue, and yes, there's money in reserves for the current year at Five Cities Fire Authority, but to continue the current practice, you know, over any time period isn't feasible. At least we don't have the ability to evaluate that right now. But given the significance of the situation, then it would certainly seem like the Five Cities Fire Authority would be considering policies, because if the idea is we're looking at station closures, then who makes that decision? And on a daily basis, if you got an emergency situation, clearly the chief needs to make it, or staffing shortages, then chief needs to make it. But the Five Cities Fire Authority Board still needs, in my opinion, to be weighing in on those big picture policy decisions.
I think you're right. And again, I wish we had a better evaluation of what we're actually looking at. We don't have it. And now the only thing we've had is closures and brownouts here in Oceano based on your decisions.
We have had closures at other stations from time to time, again, based on operational need. Where that medical call is, that would take a firefighter or potentially a firefighter and a captain in an ambulance to the trauma center or the STEMI center. We've made those decisions, and they've impacted other stations within our system as well.
Few questions. Yes. Chief, I had just a few questions before you go sit down. One was that I thought in the report, maybe I'm just misremembering, forgetting. Have we gone from 3 full-time firefighters to 6 full-time firefighters as far as that's the outlook?
So, great question. So the initial urgency hire was 3 firefighters.
Okay.
There was always a timeline of consideration of an additional 3 on July 1 of this year. So the first were consideration of hiring them in the current fiscal year.
Right.
And basically, board direction has been clarified that there will be no hires in the current fiscal year.
Gotcha. And then with that, if we were to go to the 6 full-time, would there be 0 reserve firefighters that would be on call at all?
So the short answer is no. In talking with the executive team and in discussions with the board at the last meeting, we're going to hold on to that reserve program for as long as we can. At the executive team meeting, there was discussion that if, in theory, the cities did identify funding to hire 3 firefighters in each of their communities, we would still need to give Oceano time and the option of maintaining that reserve program to maintain that 2-0 staffing here.
Okay. I guess, yeah, and that was reading through question I had, because after the last meeting, you know, I kind of thought that the impression was the reserve firefighter program doesn't work anymore. Thus, we have to go to full-time, and thus it's eliminated and gone. And then I thought more about it and thought, well, with emergencies and with things that happen and everything, can that really actually go away? It almost sounds like, for the most part, no, because you definitely want to have, you know, backups just in case. But doesn't that lead to the same question, that if we're still operating under the same reserve firefighter program today, unless we change it, there is a big emergency and issue, even with the 6 full-time. Are we going to have issues bringing reserves active? Which leads me to a further question of, is there not really the main question? Have we still not really looked at all? You know, I think there was a reserve that was here at the last meeting. He said, hey, you know, if I have another job that pays $22 an hour, I got to do what's best for my family.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking to myself, well, why don't we pay $22 an hour and then they don't go?
So I believe there were a couple of questions.
There were. There were.
Remind me if I miss one. The intent, going back to Director Colwell, if money was not the issue, we would have 9 firefighters. We would have 3 full-time firefighters here as well, plus the engineers in Station 3. So that's the perfect world that, unfortunately, we're not living in currently. So the theory was, based on the last 2 board meetings, if the cities were to move forward and start transition to full-time firefighters in those communities, Oceana is still a member of the Five Cities Fire Authority, and what we would do is hold on to the reserve firefighter program and keep it based at Station 3 while Oceano did an evaluation and determine what ultimately was going to happen in relation to fire service. To answer, maybe it's a combination of your next two questions, sustaining a reserve firefighter program. I've spent a lot of time talking to Scott Jalbert, who's the CAL FIRE unit chief for this county, and we were talking about what are we missing, right? His structure of his organization is slightly different. They're called paid call firefighters. They're not trained to the same level as our firefighters, but still he's having the same challenges. And he said, I need to be able to go to my bosses and say I've tried everything. And in talking to my people, the only thing I haven't done is put a billboard on the freeway saying, if you're interested in being a paid call firefighter, call this number and we'll have an academy. I was interviewed by New Times yesterday, and had a long discussion about this. And at the end of the interview, the reporter indicated that she had spoken to every fire chief in this county that has reserve firefighters and indicated that the thread seems to be common among all of us. Maybe I am finally answering your last question in the $22 or pay them more per hourly rate. That's something where we've talked about at the executive team level. You know, what's the sticking point? What's the take rate as to when someone will sign up and stay? We don't have an answer for that. We could certainly try, and I will tell you that if we have a reserve firefighter program in January of 2019, we're going to have to increase their pay because the minimum wage standards will catch up to the current firefighter wages. So definitely something to be taken into consideration as we go through the budget process. But again, I'm not quite sure what that number is. I know that we're actually at the higher end of the reserve programs at this county. Okay. Not that that makes it great, but that's the reality.
Okay. I guess, yeah, because I guess just that would be, you know, again, I'm still stuck on that, you know, is that, you know, have we really done, have we talked to other agencies, counties within California that, you know, has somebody done that? And, well, actually, our reserve firefighter is doing great because we pay them $25 an hour. I don't know. You know, it's just I'm curious if that answer is out there or not. You know, so that's it for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm just soaking it all in.
Yeah. You know, I have one question for the chief. Roy Grandy was talking last night about going their own way. And I'm going backwards and saying, wait a minute. The Five Cities Fires organization was established to consolidate and, in a sense, save money by putting everybody together, one chief, two battalion chiefs, so on and so forth. It was supposed to be less expensive. And I know we've done a little bit of just chalkboard to see what it would take to run a minimum fire department, and it would be real minimum on the money that we have. We might be able to keep somebody in the station all the time, but, I mean, it still would be minimum. And it seems to me that we're missing something here, because it should have been less expensive. So less expensive, but they're looking to go back to. We're not looking to go back to it, unless it is forced upon us. But they're talking about it would be less expensive to run their own fire department. That's what I heard last night from one of the city council persons. So my question is that true, or are we still being able to have an advantage of the size of the entity?
So it's a very interesting analysis, and Jim Bergman, their city manager, spent a lot of time crunching some numbers. When we were talking about that with some of the former Arroyo Grande employees that are now Five Cities Fire, they said at the time of formation, there was talk in Arroyo Grande that at some point this might no longer be a good business deal. And I think what you heard last night is Arroyo Grande's allocations 47%, so close to 50% of the whole budget. And if they did an analysis and said I had three firefighters a day and I had a chief and a battalion chief and some admin people, and maybe take all of our operating costs and divide them into thirds, that they're pretty close in their current allocation to what it would cost to staff one fire station. So I believe there's some validity to the analysis. I don't know if there's necessarily interest in moving forward, but I guess at some point it becomes that business decision to that community. What value are we getting? I know Mr. Ogren can talk to you that we were chatting about different methodologies for a funding formula allocation today to potentially make it more advantageous in that analysis. But at this point, that's what it is, an analysis.
Okay. Yudoki. Thank you.
Well, I think it's fair to say that that is in the forefront of the minds in people in Arroyo Grande. It was certainly a topic of discussion at the executive committee today. That's why it led to the discussion that if the cities are going to propose changes in funding formulas, then we need to know that as well. And it led to my recommendation that if that is the case, then maybe what we need to do is during the transition period, stay with the current funding formula, and then once it's fully transitioned, then do the evaluation of what it would mean to change the funding formula, and partly so that all the numbers don't get, you know, messed up in all the other numbers, and we could just see at full transition what are the cities looking for. Some of the basic numbers that were discussed, though, cause Oceano's contribution to not just go up significantly, but to go, you know, way up. So the transition, as has been previously identified in some of the earlier staff reports, with full transition could be $350,000 a year to Oceano. With changes in funding formulas, that number could easily double. And so if the cities want to take that approach, certainly we would have to dialogue with them. But, you know, the numbers are going to then be even that much further, you know, out of reach for us.
Yeah. Well, I suppose for this evening we should just keep working on it.
Still many more details that need to be addressed, and we'll be, you know, learning more. The big milestone is really going to be the March meeting of the Five Cities Fire Authority when they're looking at the multi-year budget outlook.
And in the interim, I'm really glad that at least our ad hoc committee is meeting with Lynn and, as well as Cal Fire and the county. I mean, we need to make some progress in evaluating what our options are, and we don't have it.
We also need to keep in mind that if we do make a decision toward asking our community for an increase in support for fire, that we need to know what the deadline is, because we pretty well got to have it on the 2018.
Well, and Pavel pretty much laid out some of those deadlines in his prior memo to us, and they're right around the corner.
That's we now, need to make. We
I,
need
I
to.
I can see that nobody wants to predict. Although, well, I don't mind being wrong, but my prediction is dismal. If we go to the public and ask for them to vote to increase their taxes, so we can get an additional six full-time firemen. That'll help the service of, I don't think we get it. I just don't think we get it from the local taxpayers.
So certainly it's a high threshold, it's a high standard. One of the things that I've done in the past, and it's been somewhat successful, is that, for example, when we did the vote for the Lopez bonds to rebuild Lopez. It's not taking the position, again, of trying to sell it, but simply laying out these are the options for the community. And when I first initiated discussions with the FISA, you know, Pismo and Arroyo Grande and Grover and Oceano about a special tax, and I believe it was voted on in the year 2000, there was similar sentiments that there was just no way it was going to pass. And sometimes the question is it our obligation to put that question in front of the voters? right? It's not a question of, hey, voters, this is what we think you should do, but simply, voters, these are the options. We know that the type of service that would be provided under the different scenarios that President White identified, there would be significant differences in the services that the community would receive. And so the analogy to Lopez sort of breaks down on the details, but a lot of times it becomes a question of, is it really something that the voters simply, they need to make the decision on? Because certainly your board has, you know, vast authority on many issues associated with this district, but you ultimately don't have that authority to levy taxes like local agencies could prior to Prop 13. And in the state's constitution and the will of the voters in California in 76, when Prop 13 was passed, it was, these are not decisions for our elected officials anymore. These are decisions for the voting public. And so whether we think it's, you know, the probability of what we think of it passing or not, sometimes we just need to set that aside, look at our options and say, okay, community, you have a decision you need to make, and whichever way you go is what we're going to implement.
Point and, well taken.
Yeah.
And we could, you had said, I believe that we could propose that in a way that they might be able to choose one going either with Cal Fire or staying with five cities, or we could have kind of a double-headed.
So it's not uncommon for votes on taxes to be accompanied with an advisory vote. What I've seen most commonly is when a city or a county, because they have general powers, special districts don't. We are limited to our special powers. We're special. The what we have seen in cities, especially doing in the past, is they'll put out a sales tax initiative, for example. And then they work through some sort of a community workshop process, and they might even have an advisory vote on where the citizens would like to see that money spent. But provided it's not compulsory on the city council, then it still meets the general tax and it requires a 50% vote. You know, once you put out a vote that says this is going to be specifically, this tax is special, it's for this specific purpose, then that triggers the two-thirds. And so it's harder to do the general tax because then the voters are sort of relying on the city council, you know, following the will, but it's still city council discretion.
Yeah.
In this case, the possibility would be is if we see different levels of cost of service, so that a special tax to finance Five Cities Fire would be a special tax under a Cal Fire would be something less, like under a B option, and there's different service levels. Well, one option would be then to go and ask for a vote on the special tax, and then secondly, an advisory vote that asks the question of where do you want the services from? And the idea being is that if the tax election passes, then the advisory vote would be then taken into consideration by your board as to how the services are going to actually be provided. And that might then lead to a lower imposition. You know, just if a tax does pass, doesn't mean that you impose it at the highest rate. Yeah. Right? You can impose it at a lesser rate. So by using that combination of a tax as well as an advisory vote, you might be able to get to community preferences a little bit under that approach. Again, something just as we're thinking about it today, no decisions, that's something that clearly isn't really for a decision till down the road.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Anything else? Anyone else? Okay.
Oh, when's the next Five City Fire? February? Okay, so I would anticipate then our next update would be at our regular, the second meeting in February.
It would be February 16th.
That would, yeah, so that would work because our second meeting is going to be February. Oh, we got to switch that page there.
20.
That's the old calendar.
I can see that far, but.
Oh. Yeah, the meeting, the fire meeting, the fire meeting would be before our second
meeting. Yeah. And by that time, I think the cities will have, you know, further done their budget workshops as well.
Yeah. Okay. We need to return to 9B, review of new laws.
Madam President, just for clarity, we did not formally take public comment on this item.
Oh, yes. I will call for a public comment. Seeing no one come forward, we will move on to 9B, review of new laws for 2018, published by the California Special Districts Association. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Madam President, members of the board, item 9B is just I wanted to provide your board with some of the information that the California Special Districts Association provided on new laws of 2018. And I'm going to kind of run through these really part 1 through 7 with some real general comments, and legal counsel will also provide some. There's nothing in here that's super earth-shattering or anything, so probably a pretty quick exercise here. So on part 1, they talked about new law SB 450, the benefits of knowing the full cost of debt financing. And that is more or less like a full disclosure law for public agencies when we go and we borrow money. They provided an example in the CSDA where once all the costs were added together, it ended up being a pretty high, what we call transaction costs. So whenever we go and borrow money, there's two types of costs. One is the transaction cost, and if we have to hire bond counsel or underwriters and those individuals, the analogy is real estate commission fees. If we go to sell a house, we have transaction costs, escrow fees. If we go to borrow money, you know, sometimes we pay points on the loans, but we certainly pay for title insurance and all that stuff. And that is often outside of what we know as being APR or annual percentage rates, right? Some of the costs, like if you have points on a loan, they have to incorporate that those points into the evaluation of what APR is because it's kind of upfront, it's loading up interest costs. But when you get quoted on APR, it doesn't include the escrow fees and, you know, title searches and some of those other fees that are necessary for making the transaction but aren't something that the mortgage lender is really collecting from you. So SB 450 is just simply saying that for public agencies, you have to do the very broad calculation of all the costs associated with issuing debt. And it's certainly something that's I've always been pretty well acquainted on. For example, when we go out and we issue municipal bonds, there's been a general rule, if it's less than $1 million, you're just going to be paying a ton of transaction costs in comparison. And so the California Special Districts Association sponsors these multi-agency bond pools so that if we had, you know, a relatively small debt issuance, $1 million or a couple $1 million, we could hook up with CSDA. They would be working with other special districts that are also trying to issue, you know, a couple $1 million or so, so that the total bond package is larger, maybe, let's say, by example, $20 million, and can have more efficiency on those transaction costs. The next one, part 2, new California law expands baby bonding leave to mid-sized employers. It simply talks about, you know, smaller agencies now have to provide baby bonding time. Used to be called maternity leave, but, of course, both the moms and the dads get to exercise that right today. I kind of wish it was around 25, 26 years ago. I would have enjoyed it, but it's a good thing. It's not applicable to OCSD, though, because the size is what?
We're too small.
Yeah, we're too small. I can't remember if it was 20, 25?
20, 49 employees.
Yeah. So typically a lot of these things we see is for employers with 50 or more employees, and for baby bonding they've dropped it down, but still we're small. Of course, if there is a baby bonding opportunity in Oceano, we will work with our parents to the greatest degree possible so that they could do the baby bonding. But legally, Part 3, SB 231, and how special districts can help with water reliability is something that has been in the works in Sacramento for years. And even this article talks about, well, we'll see where it goes and how it might pan out with litigation. But the basic story about that is when Prop 218 was adopted, it requires, you know, Prop 218 provides multiple avenues to try to, you know, generate revenues for whatever needs are. And we talked a little bit about that with the Five Cities Fire Authority today and special taxes and whatnot. But voter approval requirements are exempt for water, sewer, and garbage. The idea being is that when a public agency goes to increase water rates or sewer rates, garbage rates, you don't have to do a formal vote, but it's subject to a protest vote. And the challenge that a lot of municipalities have seen in California, which is not our challenge because we don't have drainage responsibilities, is the ability to fund drainage. And it's been subject to a lot of regulations and mandates by the State Water Board and the Regional Water Boards in terms of getting all the litter out of the flow of water so it doesn't get into drainage channels and whatnot. So local agencies have had a lot of struggles with adequately funding drainage. And what SB 231 essentially does is it modifies the definition of sewage to include stormwater sewage. And there is some validity to that, there's no doubt. Historically, wastewater collection systems were tied directly into sewer systems. They were one and the same. And it's only as time went by that we separated them, in part because when you had big rain events, they would flood your sewer systems. Initially, that wasn't deemed to be a problem because the solution to pollution is dilution. And if a storm sewer is going through there and it's flushing it out to the ocean, then all is good. But of course, today we have higher senses of environmental responsibility than the days of old. So we've separated our, you know, the stormwater sewer systems with the, you know, house sewer systems. And the evaluation in Sacramento has definitely relied on inconsistencies between language to take the position that they can do this. And yet the question will be, will there be litigation and will the court strike down SB 231? The only tie I can see into Oceano is if we wanted to establish rates and charges to collect stormwater and to reintroduce it into the groundwater supply. But we would probably use our water resource responsibility there. And there was a Pajaro case that probably would give us some ability to do that. Not a high priority for us, but it will be interesting to see how SB 231 plays out. Part 4, changes to control guidelines, detect and prevent financial errors and fraud. So that simply is giving the State Comptroller's Office the ability to come in and audit us, which, of course, based on our fine work by our business and accounting manager and our promotion of transparency and good government, if they ever wanted to do so, they're very well invited to come in and audit us. Right now, the county auditor can do so and charges for it only if we're late on producing our own financial audit. So this gives the State Comptroller's Office some broader authorities, and I would guess that part of that is prompted based on misdeeds that we've seen in other local agencies. Part 5, two bills addressing pay disparities, AB 168 and AB 108. Those are noteworthy because we can no longer ask for salary information from applicants, and we can no longer use that salary information as a basis for what type of salary offering we might play. And I don't know if you read more into that, but that's kind of the nutshell that I saw on there. Is that's it.
Except for public employees, people that we can ask salary information for, people who have prior experience in the public sector.
And that's because that's public information anyhow, but we're still not allowed to use it to determine how much we're going to pay them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a common practice. How much did you get paid and what kind of incentive? Because we want you to come and work here. So In fact, I've probably done that in the past, asked how much are you getting paid and what's it going to take you to come here and stuff like that. And so no more doing that. It was all happy before. Jeff? Part six, to indemnify and defend. SB 496 was strongly opposed. Oh, what? So.
No, he did.
I covered 168. What was 1008 was in there too? It was related.
Yeah. And it's, in regards to questions related to criminal background. You want to talk about that?
Yes. So the criminal background check says not until you've provided a tentative offer. That's already our practice. It is a common practice amongst many local agencies that yeah, it has nothing to do with elected officials, Director Colwell, though, so we still can't ask. but it's so a number of states already had this law in place. And a lot of local agencies, including this district, already followed the practice. And it's an important one because if we make an offer to somebody, we say it's contingent on two different things. One is background checks, and the other is the health check, medical, especially if, you know, you're out working in the field and have some weight, you know, ability to lift or carry weights or something. The importance of not doing, especially the criminal background prior to the offer, is that it's because when you do it after the offer, then the public agency has to explain why the offer is going to get rescinded. So, for example, if somebody is offered a job to work in the field as one of our water system operators, and they did a deed associated with bouncing checks or something that, you know, was technically pops up on their background check, but it's fiscal in nature and it has nothing to do with operations out in the field, then would that really be a basis for denying them a job? On the other hand, if it was somebody who was applying for an accounting position that had some internal control functions associated with it, then yeah, something associated with criminal background to do with money could be very relevant on whether or not, you know, we could place them into a position with fiduciary responsibilities. Yeah. So the idea is that the law essentially is setting that path that says you can't do it until you've set the offer, and then whether it's expressive or inferred, that if you deny them once you see it, you better be able to explain why it's relevant in the hiring decision.
And they have the opportunity to respond.
Oh, and they have the opportunity. Thank you, legal counsel. So, again, practice we've been following, and it's a good law. So now to part six, the indemnification of defense. And a lot of public agencies, especially the larger ones, were opposed to this because it affects how we can write contracts with consultants. So, for example, the county had a historical practice of if a consultant is at all in fault on a particular item, even if it's 1% at fault, then they pick up the liability. And it's a transfer of risk provision that's common in contracts, both between public agencies and private, as well as between private parties. Again, contract negotiations and transferring risk is part of contract negotiations. So the consulting industry has been working on the legislature for years as to not allowing public agencies to do that type of risk transfer, and instead that basically everybody is just responsible for their share, and it gets into some more details associated with defense and other things. Okay, so, you know, the professional consulting world were able to successfully lobby and get this legislation. Is it going to really have much of a bottom line effect you know, on Oceano, and the answer is no. That if we really got into a construction type of a dispute and what kind of services were provided by, you know, our consultants, everybody ultimately would be sitting around the table to try to negotiate settlements, you know, all the insurance providers from everybody. With respect to larger agencies, yeah, they liked the previous law because it gave them a little bit more negotiating, bargaining room when issues did come up. But again, it's for our size of agency, I don't think it's really going to have much effect.
What about the hold harmless agreements?
Well, hold harmless agreements, that's really how it comes in. And the what is happening in this and what the change of the law here really is about is that design professionals were often put on the hook to defend. And it was really the issue about the defense before liability was determined. So even if a design professional is determined to have 1% liability at the end, they would be on the hook to defend the case in whole all the way through. And the amount of apportionment of liability doesn't come up, usually isn't decided, till well into the case. So they could be fronting 100% of the defense costs to then find out I'm only 1% liable. And so what this bill does, it says, is the way this is framing this is that the design professional should only be responsible for, if 25% at fault, 25% of the defense costs. Yeah, but how are they going to figure that?
But how do you prejudge that?
So we're going to see how that pans out.
Yeah.
I always think those kind of things, they just cause the legal community and the attorneys to take slightly different approaches, yeah. Or to wrangle their hands and figure that the ka-ching is coming, but... Yeah, that's right. Jab back. Yeah.
Part 7.
New option now, legal for records retention. So part of the record retention policies, we have to have a permanent and secure place to be able to maintain our records. Most can be maintained electronically. There are some records that we have to keep the original hard copies of.
But you can put them in the cloud.
But now you can put them in the cloud, yeah. So
into the ether.
Into the ether. And because much of our information is public information anyhow, you know, whether it's on the cloud or on our hard drives, it's still public and it's accessible to the public. So, again... it's a new option, again, probably helping large agencies with the huge database, you know, maintenance requirements, because the cloud certainly is opening up some of those options. And then Part 8, which I didn't really study, was a bunch of miscellaneous CSD-sponsored legislation that's now law. So that is our quick summary on new legislation in 2018. It does have some effects on us. Some of it is current practices, the contract stuff. Isn't, but nothing in here that I see as being earth-shattering or having significant effects on us in 2018.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. Moving forward, we have no hearing items. Do we have any received written communications?
Yes. So today I did receive an email from County Public Works, Sarah, and I'm forgetting Sarah's last name. They're submitting a grant application for the levy, Zone 1 and 1A. So they're hoping to get a letter of support, and I'll be talking to her in the morning and might track you down, President White, to get you to sign a letter of support on behalf of the county's grant application efforts.
Do we need to take any action on
that? No, because as the president, you're generally authorized consistent with board policies.
Okay.
And this is one of those ones where it's certainly not inconsistent with any board policies. So, yeah. You know, unless the board actually wanted to weigh in or something. Again, I don't see anything as being inconsistent with your role as being president.
Sounds fine to me.
And so that was recently received written communication. You know, obviously in the Five Cities Fire Authority staff report, I had included some communications there, but haven't gotten anything else that would directly pertain to either a current or anticipated agenda item.
Okay. Then moving on to future agenda. We're busy.
Yes. And in the GM report, I had kind of identified that there's a lot of, I know I've got a lot of work that I'm focusing on that is not really related to board policies. So the timing is good for the special meeting with Seabreeze Mobile Home, and we have basically coordinated February 13th, 2018, a start time of having it starting promptly on that Seabreeze item at 3:30. Since we will have accounts payable and some other types of things, we figured we'd start the meeting at 3. We're hoping Seabreeze would be here early, and then as soon as Director Brunet is able to show up, then we would start that particular agenda item. And we have basically about an hour because legal counsel for Seabreeze has got a commitment at 5 o'clock in San Luis on kids' court, trial court, mock
what
court?
Is that meeting again?
Mock trial,
Seabreeze
yeah.
Meeting?
February.
Oh, it's
February. Okay.
So it would be February 13th.
February 13th. Oh,
okay.
And I think that would be pretty good timing. I'll anticipate about a 15-minute staff presentation on Seabreeze. And then we'll need to work out the protocol with President White, but we're generally encouraging Seabreeze to have a spokesperson, one or two, you know, the attorney and maybe a spokesperson, so that they are focused in on their presentation and their points to your board. Because if there's a long line of residents from Seabreeze who want to speak one after another, we won't get done in the hour time, that's for sure. But also, it's more likely they're going to be better at expressing their points if it's done through, you know, a single voice or a voice in their attorney or a relatively few in number. So certainly it's their discretion as to whether they do that, but we're encouraging them along those lines.
Could they use more time if we started earlier, or can they get here? No, you can't get here.
Right.
Early. Yeah, and I think as a point of clarification, I think Nicole had sent out, it went from 3:30 to 3.
Yeah, so the starting of the meeting was going to be 3.
Okay.
And then we're going to still need to do accounts payable, you know, disbursements, and yeah. Might have a couple of other little items.
Yeah.
Where we would take care of those immediately, and then as soon as Director Brunet showed up, we could start with Seabreeze.
Okay. Yeah.
And even if we needed to resort the agenda like we did today a little bit, we would be able to do so on the 13th, so that the key is as soon as Director Brunet shows up, we want to be moving into the Seabreeze discussions.
Good. All the time they...
So February 13th, the regular meeting of February 14th then, I'm recommending for cancellation, in part because we're going to be having the special meeting on the 13th, but more particularly, and it's not because it's is the 14th Valentine's Day? Yeah, it was 14th or 15th.
Still is.
So I need to be traveling to Sacramento on the 14th because I have my CUCAC meeting on the 15th. And I was not able to meet in the December meeting due to the passing of my father. And so they have some pretty strict rules in terms of attendance as well. And I need to be at that one. And apparently we're going to actually have a protest. So CUCAC rules when there's complaints from private industry as to public agencies that don't go out to bid when they should have gone out to bid. That's kind of our single authority. And so I'm not sure the agency, but there are some contractors that are challenging a public agency for not going out to bid.
Ooh.
And so sounds like we're going to actually have a hearing item on the 15th.
Does anybody have a problem with the 13th and the 14th? I certainly don't.
Not at all.
No, we're fine. We're happy. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else? Oh.
I just wanted to announce that this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, there's going to be a model railroad show at the depot. San Luis Model Railroad Association and the Oceano Depot Association. It's the yearly event. Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 4. And the depot will be selling hot dogs and popcorn, and there will be lots of model trains. So it's a very, very exciting show.
Very good for children of all ages.
Right. Supposed to be warm, too, so that'll
Yeah, and the
nice.
Weather's going to be beautiful. Come have a hot dog. Oh, yeah.
And there will be a pancake breakfast in February at the depot, February 11th. So I know I get a lot of questions when our next pancake breakfast is, so there will be one on February 11th, Sunday from 8 to 11:30.
All right.
So I'll make sure you get that down for you.
Got it. Yeah. Anything else from anyone else? I then would entertain a motion.
I move we adjourn.
I second it.
All in favor, moved and adjourned. Ended at 8:20. President Board of Directors.
And then this is the engagement letter with Moss Levy for the audit.
Okay.
So I was going to, your governance and then the engagement side.
Okay.
Thanks. I should probably should have put some arrows. Thank you.
So you guys didn't want any of those beautiful belts?
No, we did grab a notebook and stamp.
Here, this is first. Yeah. Okay, I'll come get the stuff tomorrow or the next day.
We'll go through it again.
Well, there's some cute belts there.
Oh, I didn't see the belts. I was on the first place, but I'll look again.
You didn't see the belts?
No.
Did you see the socks?
No. I think I got this.